Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the shadows of the Night Zone.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, madam and messieurs. Welcome to
the Night Zone.
This is a live event.
John Hoke is the author of over 20 books. With millions in print in 17 languages, John, like Nostradamus, thinks outside of the box while harnessing those ancient understandings. A world authority on Nostradamus and the prophetic traditions of the world in the Night Zone Shadows tonight, John Hoke of HokeProphecy.com. The following program is intended for entertainment and information purposes only. The Night Zone is merely the purveyor of information. You, the audience, shall judge the quality of information offered. We remind all of our listeners, Caveat Emptor, ladies and gentlemen, your host, Colin Nash.
Okay, guys, a nice touch. Here comes the night. I got it. Funny stuff. Tonight, as we go to air, guys, in Calgary, Alberta, Canada, the outside temperature has dropped to a minus 20 degrees Celsius. Yes, it's a bone-chilling, blowing, wind-killing kind of a night. The wind chill feels well below minus 30, and as we all know, at minus 32, Celsius and Fahrenheit are equal. So it is cold out there. Special shout-outs tonight to those on the front line of tonight's first major winter storm in southern Alberta. Many who listen to the shows live and archive, police, fire, EMS, grader and salt crews, city workers on call at a moment's notice to do the impossible, and of course those angels of mercy who provide for the homeless. Our respect and blessings are with you all tonight. It will be a difficult night in the downtown Calgary streets, so we ask that you all be careful out there. Shout-outs to new and old friends who are tuning in tonight. Greetings to Heather of Calgary, EMR Dave, BC Dreamcatcher, Beth, the Southeast Brickies Much Better Half, Last Song of the Night, Beth, Jesse from Manchester, England, and special birthday shout-outs to Luke from Sarah in California. And, of course, all of our listeners around the world, welcome to the live edition of The Night Zone. It is Friday, November the 19th, 2010. And we have back with us one of our favorite guests, Mr. John Hoke from HokeProphecy.com. Good evening, sir, and welcome back to the Night Zone.
Thanks for having me back on, Colin.
I'm really excited. I got to tell you, John, your predictions earlier this year, and then looking at what's happening today, more people should have paid attention, I think.
Well, it is... It is a strange thing to always watch how these annual almanacs play out for me, because in the process of writing them, I often feel like I can't imagine a lot of this is going to take place. A lot of it I don't want to have take place.
Right.
But the discipline of the oracle that I use, which, to make a long story short, is a simple meditation, just step out of my own way and allow a very effortless, such as the case, presence just simply write. Not like automatic writing. It's hard to explain, because it's really my part in it is to just, the effort is to be effortless, to step out of the way. And in that, I have to innocently and openly trust whatever is put out there. And it always surprises me, because it's not done with a lot of effort, or It's not done like in Hollywood prophecy movies, like Nostradamus or Check Icario climbing the walls of his library because he saw something in the future.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
It's actually very boring how I do it, but the consequences are always puzzling and humbling when I see things happening. I think somewhat what helps in the process of looking at the future is that one must rely not on something that's cynical, but something that's a reality. There's sometimes a fine line between what looks cynical and what looks to be the fact. And the fact is that when you look into the stars or when you look into the patterns of human behavior, as long as the human race, each of us individually and collectively, have to be burdened every birth with identities and egos and a collective national or religious mindsets,
right,
whether be they theist or atheist religious mindsets, as long as these things are dumped on us, coding over our born, birth-given intelligence, we tend to follow certain mechanical patterns, individually and collectively, that if one can see these patterns in oneself, one can very accurately read the future. And I would not claim it to be merely a reading through some psychic gift, although there is that involved too.
So you think there is a defined, for lack of a better word, formula to the happenings of our spirit, of our being?
Not of our spirit, but of the thing that coats the spirit,
okay,
and that is the persona, the personality,
right,
which in Latin means mask, persona,
right,
and so it's false. But we are trained by our society to think that the false is the true, and it's very ironic because anybody who's born into this world, no matter what corner of the earth you end up in, you end up having to survive by adapting as a child to the culture. If you're born a woman in Afghanistan in a Taliban village,
right,
guess who's wearing the burqa?
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
It's,
yeah,
not. But if you were born in a more liberally tolerant society, a secular society, you might have the bias of the French with people, Muslims, wearing shawls in public areas in France, where a kind of reverse, like, we're so secular that we won't let you wear any religious garb. But on the other hand, they let the priests and the Catholic Church and wear their garb. So, you see, it's all a coding that's over us. And if one has a good sense of the patterns of history, both past and future, which takes a certain intuition into this homo mechanicus kind of quality of our race, our human race,
right,
then one can read the signs. And one does this not to go, ha ha, look at all you machines out there doing what I said you'd do. It's done actually to stop the program.
Right.
I am anti-prophetic. My work is anti-prophetic. I am trying, using prophecy, to bring people back into the present where they really are empowered to see what makes them mechanical and to stop it.
Right.
Because spontaneous, intelligent people are much harder to predict than robots.
Yeah. And we are all somewhat conditioned, either through the media of one form or another, or our method of getting the message across. When we opened up the Night Zone, we didn't want to conform as tightly as was required of us to get the message out. We wanted to flow a little differently, but it's next to impossible to swim against the current. So it must be difficult for you, John, to come with the information that you bear. And for instance, to put it down in your blog or on your newspaper and your web searches and to stand by those. I mean, your accuracy is astounding.
It also, the strange thing about accuracy is that it brings a lot of psychic persecution and sometimes direct trouble. It's something I noticed when I did the biography on Nostradamus, A Life in Myth for HarperCollins, and I sell that book on HogueProphecy.com.
Right.
And it's the first full 450-page biography of Nostradamus that was done in a couple hundred years.
Mm-hmm.
And, in fact, there hasn't been a full-body biography until I wrote it. The strange thing about Nostradamus is that you would think there's so much material that there would be full-bodied biographies out there in the classic sense. But then,
yeah,
when I was halfway through the book, I came to understand why there weren't. You cannot divide or separate Nostradamus, the factual man, from his myth. So I embarked on not doing that and simply saying, calling the book Nostradamus, A Life and Myth.
Mm-hmm.
Because, and looking at myth in all of its dimensions, meaning fraud to a fact that is more universal and higher than
right.
mundane fact,
right.
the essential truth higher than history, and all points in between. When I looked at Nostradamus, I found it very interesting in his own life that once he started writing the prophecies, he was considered a bit of a entertainment, certainly, and was regarded as something rather silly, even in his own times, but not completely. You know, the Queen of France was very interested in his work. It was very interesting to see, though, a few years after she made him famous by endorsing his prophecies, by having him visit for a royal audience in Paris, he started to have accuracy in what he had documented. He started to name names and locations for the major military disaster that befell France in a few years after 1555, in a battle they lost against the Spanish. And he had an anagram of the generals, the second in command of the general, and he described how the generals... brother ran through the swamps to get away from the Spaniards. And, you know, people looked at that and went, this guy was right. And then when he started writing about the astrology that showed a civil war coming, and when he started to show his accuracy, even in his own contemporary prophecies, that's when Nostradamus got in trouble. If he had been like we have around all over the place these days on shows, these people who are remarkably entertaining and remarkably inaccurate in their prophetic statements, they make a career out of this great inaccuracy, and they never get any trouble.
Mm-hmm.
But when you hit the nail on the head, and when you also do something that is part of prophecy, I've had many people say, oh, we love your prophecy books and all, but please, why do you always get into politics? Because, you know, prophecy shouldn't be about politics. And I have to remind them that politics comes from the root of the word for people.
Mm-hmm.
It's about people. People are politics. People relate back and forth in a political manner. And in the larger extent, when you're talking about the future of peoples, you're talking about political bodies called nations, supernations,
right.
intranations, like the EU.
Yeah.
You know, I have to tell people that if you want me to speak about your future, you're going to have to accept the fact that sometimes I'm going to say something about your political future that goes against your projections.
Exactly.
And I've done that on all sides, right, left, and center in my country, in America, where I was born, with the persona mask of American that I wear, but I am not of my mask. I deal rather intensely in the last few months with the midterm elections and predictions that I made about it. That came true. That basically what we had was a mandate of anger, which I foresaw happening as far back as early July.
Yeah, I remember we discussed that you saw something brewing. And the one thing you said during, and I hate to go back to the actual run-up to the election, but you said something that rattled in my head for a while, and you said that you saw two presidents, and you couldn't distinguish that. Well, what was going there? There was something you weren't sure about. And now as we go 2 years into the Obama presidency, the rumblings are that there is a draft Hillary program starting up to take a run at 2012 if Obama's numbers and popularity doesn't change. So
I have for years, as far back as early 2007, a year before the political campaigns and the primaries in America even started,
mm-hmm.
I have written on record saying that I saw very clearly in the destiny of Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, they've both become presidents of the United States.
Right.
I had thought, and what the message I got was, the timeline that was more profitable for the world and its progress would have been that Hillary Clinton becomes president and Barack Obama becomes her vice president and learns the job in one or two terms.
Right.
And then he become then he is seasoned and ready by 2012 at the earliest or 2016 at the latest to be a very good president of the United States.
And still young enough to be effective.
Yeah. And the thing is that I said that there's a potential danger because of the hubris of impatient ambition that Barack Obama would rush it, push Hillary Clinton aside, turn it kind of backwards.
Right.
And throw her into the future and throw himself too early into the present when he is unseasoned, immature, and not ready to be president of the United States. And he would, if he was elected in 2008, it would be a great tragedy because he would also, although there's an outside chance that, if try and be as positive as I can, there's an outside chance that something good can come out of this because it's always better to come to your destiny too early rather than too late because you can catch up. But I am not at this moment seeing Barack Hussein Obama grokking this, understanding this, and catching up. What I see him is crumbling back. Now, in the new predictions for 2011, I write at length about this strange karmic connection that Barack Obama has with Abraham Lincoln and this whole kind of upside-down destiny that's happened with him and Hillary Clinton. I also, even when he was going to be president-elect and I predict he'd be president, I still saw him in a dream team with Hillary Clinton, even after she was denied the vice president's position. I couldn't shake it. And it's in all my documented articles in HokeProphecy.com.
Yeah.
And lo and behold, he gets elected, and he picks her to actually be a more influential partner as Secretary of State than being Vice President.
Exactly.
And what I do see happening is the chapter is called The Second Coming of Change We Can Believe In?
Right.
And kind of playing a little satirically at the kind of messianic qualities that actually got Barack Obama into a lot of trouble. It's just one of his immature signs, is that he kind of played, I call it Don Obama One, you know, promise them anything but give them Arpege, you know, promise the American electorate anything they wanted. And without a lot of substance, it's more run on emotion and rhetoric than substance. And then what people discovered is that once it became president, it's pretty much just emotion and rhetoric. Well, not emotion. So he has to, this coming year is his 2011 is like Abraham Lincoln's 1863.
Right.
If Abraham Lincoln, by 2 years into his presidency, nobody thought he was going anywhere except down the dunny, in history as one of the worst American presidents. Not only that, but a president that might actually bring an end to the Union of the United States in the Civil War because of his disastrous choices in generals.
Right.
Equally disastrous are Obama's choices in financial experts.
Yeah. Oh, I'll say that, yeah.
This is the battlefront that Obama must fight. He's fortunate that he doesn't have to choose the generals who fight brother against brother in his own nation. But his battlefield is the economic front, and he has so far fought it by listening to very old-think dogmatic views about what needs to be done from the inside, the people that have actually been part responsible for the collapse.
Well, I think that was partially... I thought it was a revelation when I first saw that Geithner was stepping out, and I thought, okay, you know, we're heading somewhere here. And when you started to see some of the old financial guard that got Obama into power, when you see them starting to fade away and be replaced by some pretty sharp-looking cookies, you realize that Obama is serious about getting his house in order. But my concern, John, is, as you say, his inability to understand the world and the team around him not being able to give him what is needed. That's one thing Reagan learned was surround yourself with experts and you look like a genius.
Well, Reagan also had something. It's a good comparison because Obama likes to mistakenly think of himself as a Democratic Ronald Reagan. Even though I like to hear that he invites teams of historians over for dinner to talk about the presidency and all that. You can read the books, but if you don't absorb it, it doesn't help you much, no matter how many books you read. And I'm rather surprised and taken by the fact that, you know, one thing that Ronald Reagan had, whatever people think about Ronald Reagan, one look at his astrology and you see a man who was a natural-born executive. The other thing, too, is that if you have been the president of the Screen Actors Guild, I grew up in Hollywood. I'm from that industry, and I can tell you, if you can be an executive overseeing that union, you're going to learn a lot about politics.
Oh, yeah.
And a lot about running shop.
Oh yeah.
Then you move from there to be the governor for two terms of the fifth largest economy in the world, California.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Ronald Reagan came to the White House with a lot of experience. What has Barack Obama come? Look at his legislative record. There's almost nothing there. The only thing that he could even dig up in his own autobiography was his ability to excite people in South Chicago slums. But when I read his book, it was like once he excited them, he handed the real day-to-day grinding, dirty work of getting things turned around to those single mothers who were managing their kids as well as managing the neighborhoods.
Right.
And then he went off to Harvard and greater glory and greater rises to the climbing the mountain of prestige and power.
And I think every leader that aspires to those positions in some way or another, you know, they do the same thing. They're destined to go where they're going. It seems like they're on a divine mission sometimes, whether they're right or wrong. And I do like how you said that Clinton should have been first, and she could have handed off to Obama once he learned the ropes. And, you know, that is an interesting twist of reality that is so logically possible, Jim.
Well, there often happens that certain predictable destinies are just, their momentum is there. It's a question of how the sequence comes in the final reckoning.
Mm-hmm.
And there's often a time when you see a thing and it says, she's supposed to be first, him second. Now, he skewered that and it became upside down. Now we have an upside down future. And not only that, we have a situation where, in a way, Barack Obama is a man of the times.
Mm-hmm.
He has climbed the ladder of entitlement in this badly named concept called meritocracy, which is one of the words I value the most because I foresee in about 100 or 200 years, a meritocratic system of government will be the next step beyond true democracy, which we don't have yet. What we live now in today's world is what I call mobocracy,
mm-hmm.
which it means, you know, the masses, vote by the masses that can be manipulated by forces, corporate and otherwise,
right,
to rush to the left like it did in 2008, and the same energy of vague pie-in-the-sky promises rushes to the right in 2010.
And we have the same thing in Canada, and when I grew up in Britain, it was the same way. There never seemed to be a consistency. One government would spend half of their term reversing what the other government had done or putting roadblocks in place in case they didn't make it in the second term. And to me, it was just a waste of program. And seems so to this day, John, and I'm sure you're feeling the same way watching the silliness that goes on sometimes. I mean, this wrangle, you know, the man should have been thrown out of on the steps of the Congress and sent back home to where he belongs.
Well, it's because he wrangled too many deals, you know.
Exactly.
I find it very ironic, the pun in his name.
Yeah.
But the thing is, in the bigger picture, democracy, the true concept of democracy requires a maturity of the citizenry and its servants, public servants, that just hasn't happened yet in the world. So with all best intentions, and even though I support the often difficult, frustrating process, because I can see farther down in the centuries where this will lead to a higher form of government called meritocracy.
Right.
For Barack Obama to call himself part of the meritocratic elite class, but if he said that to me, I'd say, you seem not to know what the word merit means. What is meritorious about your life? What have you achieved? Mm-hmm. Where's your PT 109 moment?
Yeah.
Where's your being the governor of a state or the governor of a union? Other than audacity and the hope that audaciousness can get you somewhere, what have you really done?
Mm-hmm.
And I caught a lot of hell for saying a lot of that in the years when Obama hysteria was at its peak. You should have seen the angry letters that I got.
Oh, I can imagine.
I don't hear those people. I'd like those people who sent all those angry emails, hit-and-run emails, to come back and assess what I've said now that we're seeing, unfortunately, that Barack Obama is immature and not up for the job.
And
turn that around in this year. Lincoln was not ready for the job either,
right. But
Lincoln turned it around.
Right.
Lincoln finally, after Gettysburg, which turned the tide, so there might be some incident that might inspire this president to move into some kind of great mode. That often is where great presidents exploit crises. They're not made by them.
Right.
And if he does that, he'll be fine. I mean, if Roosevelt wasn't there for, and if there had been no World War II, that is, Roosevelt would not have been remembered as that great a president.
Mm-hmm.
George W. Bush was remembered more and got two terms because of how he initially dealt with 9/11 and grasped the public's inspiration in this country
right. By
standing on the pile of rubble saying, I hear you, and soon our enemies will hear you. Obama's got to have one of those moments and then exploit it like good presidents do. And if he does, and he has to do it this year coming, what he also has to do is pick his Ulysses S. Grant on the economic front,
right. Which
he keeps picking McClellans and Popes and Burnsides and all the really bad generals.
Right.
And he keeps picking them from a rather disturbing source. Now the new one, Austin Goolsbee, who is kind of eclipsing Geithner, is Skull and Bones.
Mm-hmm.
And like after the... you must be getting to the commercial soon. I want to talk a little bit about the influence of this secret society and the shaping of plutocratic elites and how they're very much involved in Obama's administration.
And absolutely. And we're going to take a very quick break, about a minute 40, and we'll be right back, and we'll get right into that, John. Hang in there.
Tonight. In the shadows of the Night Zone, John Hoag of HoagProphecy.com returns with prediction from HoagProphecy.com next.
The Aquarian Age is a time of greater spontaneity. It's going to be a time where the era of the great faith-based religions of the Piscean Age will fade and be replaced by religions that are more scientific. Rather than to believe, the next 2,000 years is about knowing.
Welcome to the shadows of the Night Zone.
It is a real phenomenon, and there's quite a few of us, and some of us are privileged to have been briefed on some of it. It's been well covered up by all of our governments for the last 6 years or so, but slowly it's leaked out. And
ladies and gentlemen, your host, Colin Knight.
And we have with us tonight John Hoag from HoagProphecy.com. If you go to HoagProphecy.com, go down into the guest section. You can sign up for John's blog, and you get a lot of updates and the upcomings and thoughts and process. And it's a pretty good, decent way of keeping up to what's happening out there in the world. And, John, we do appreciate you taking time out from your writing. I know you've been writing like crazy, so I do appreciate it. Now, the one thing that I find fascinating with you, John, that stands you out from all of those others that claim to be able to see what's happening, is you write on your blog, it's dated, it's timed. And when you go back 6 months, 8 months later, it stands true. Now, that's one heck of a way of standing behind a prediction.
Well, it always impressed me when I studied other seers and wrote about them. The way, you know, there are thousands and thousands of potential seers to look at. And I certainly get every day people writing in talking about all the wonderful things they've already predicted. I always retort that saying, oh, that's wonderful, and I can't really qualify whether that's true or not, but let's do a test. Right. Give me 10 predictions for the coming year, and a year from now I will assess what you said, and if you're 75% or more accurate, I'm definitely going to endorse what you're saying, but they never come back. So the thing that I've always appreciated is those prophets through history that have had a documented track record, that were lucky enough to have their documented track record survive the
right.
worms and times of destruction of history. And I felt that when I started making my own stabs into this, that I should always leave, since 1999 when I started doing HoagProphecy.com, I should always leave a record of what I say so that people in the future can see where I got things right and where I got things wrong.
Right.
So that we could learn something about using myself as a subjective scientific experiment, find out what, learn something more about this facility of being able to look into the future.
Right. Now, given the ability and the fact that you're documenting, And I do go back. I'm kind of a nosy little soul, and once I get onto a storyline, I like to follow it to, first of all, where it came from and where it's going. And I do enjoy your thread of information because it's a true timeline, and it is genuine. There are some areas where I would maybe discuss with you the political mantra of that direction, but the direction is the same. And I wish politicians would come away from being a Republican or a Democrat or a liberal or a conservative and just become a North American, an American, a Canadian, and get the job done instead of all of this slapping that they do at each other. When you look into your prophecies for the future, John, do you see a clearing of this political beehive of silliness? Do you see anything there?
Not for a while. Unfortunately, what I see in the long term is I'm constantly trying to help in my ways through hopefully enlightening people with what I say on radio, TV, and books. I know that a lot of very powerful people actually read me.
Mm-hmm.
It's a guilty pleasure.
Mm-hmm.
And I know there are people in the White House who read me.
And you got
so,
it like that.
Yeah, and that is in every White House that I've been, all the years I've been published, whether it's Republican or Democrat, because
right.
I'm actually neither. I consider myself a free wing, not a left wing or a right wing, but free
right.
wing. If my bias leads anywhere, it leads towards that radical concept in our current political discourse called balance,
right.
common ground,
mm-hmm.
The things that we share. I am planning to write a book, a manifesto on the revolution of the middle way in the future, when we get closer to the crazy political prediction times that are going to come for 2012.
And I can imagine.
Well, there could be at least 3 to 4 different runs on the presidency, and the winner may be, we might not have seen this kind of a thing since 1860, when a minority, the largest minority vote won the presidency for Abraham Lincoln.
Yeah, and I think what's happening, John, as you predicted as far back as late 2007, because I checked this one out too, is the fact that the political parties, especially in the United States, are fracturing, while political parties in Europe are becoming coalitions.
Yes, and the other thing, too, that's happening in America, which is a big theme of my new book, Predictions for 2011, which should be out mid-December. And if you're on that newsletter list, you'll be the first to know when it's out. I mean, I'm literally writing it. I just took a break to do this show. And I wrote 47,000 words of text for it in the last 2 weeks, which, of course, will be trimmed down to more cogent form, but it usually comes out that way. The thing that's happening is a political shift towards the ungovernable. And that's usually where mobocracy leads. That's the destiny of mobocracy. When mob rule, when the lowest common denominator has the most votes to dictate, sort of like government by dancing with the stars, you know, where the real meritorious people, the people with the talent and the insight, often disturb the mob mind in us. We prefer to choose people who are deep down, we feel, maybe not consciously, but we feel are below us, even below and beneath the mob. And that's why you get some of these types of people in great power in politics, because on some level they are below the mob mentality. The problem with this kind of thinking is it eventually leads to emergency rule, which is a euphemism for fascism. And we are entering, the whole world is about to enter, especially with China dictating how the economic world will be. Certainly it will influence in its very short Chinese century, which is only going to last 20 years. The Chinese, we forget, the Chinese government is totalitarian. It would be like Joseph Stalin waking up one day and realizing that capitalism flourishes better in a totalitarian state. Something I've been saying for decades and getting a lot of trouble here in America for saying, but, you know, monopolist economists who, and I'm not talking about true capitalism, but people who basically want to monopolize a situation, not have the government putting their nose into things, letting them make as much money as they like, not to be too worried about sweatshops or unions or issues.
The Bilderbergs or the Carlyle groups or the Illuminati, the New World Order, that kind of thing.
You want like the German economist wanted, a Chancellor Hitler to break the logjam of bad democratic or social democrat parties in the Weimar Republic. You want to give a coalition government to Adolf Hitler because he's pro-business. And once he gets in power, he promises to abolish the labor unions. And he did. And that's ironic because he called himself a national socialist, which is a socialism based on ethnic grouping of the entire nation being one ethnic group, the Germans, the Teutons.
There were many oxymorons about Adolf Hitler in his life. Very contradictory person.
But the thing I understood from reading about all this is that that bad capitalism, the kind that's inhuman, I mean, there's very good capitalism, because without the people who create wealth, that's one half of the equation. You've also got to have the people who can build the things, but there is a talent and a genius in creating wealth. And capitalism has been a great blessing to this world. But what we have now is developing into a monopolism in politics and corporation control. In fact, I've been talking about it since 2008. I call it the rise of the new aristocracy of the world, the CEO oligarchy. And it is basically a power like an aristocracy or a monarchist power or plutocracy above elected officials or those who are totalitarian of officials, politicians. And I saw the moves happening in this year with the Supreme Court in the United States allowing corporations to be viewed as equal citizens to human citizen Americans. I don't know how much influence I have on my local congressman with the little money that I have, but if the next guy next door to me is called BP, Citizen BP, Citizen AIG, he's got a lot deeper pockets and lobbyists that he can hire and wine and dine my congressman much more than I can.
Right.
And so clearly I see that, and it is a big theme in my new book for the next year, 2011, is that there's a very concerted, serious move of what I call the revolution of Politicorp to use the hysteria and manipulate the anger of the American people and the frustration to not make government smaller in this country, but dismantle it. Not to restore the constitutional rights of citizens as they were understood by the founding fathers of America, but to trump them. Using the very people who think that all this billions of dollars that flooded into this election, off a lot of it from overseas, is done in the favor of their principles.
Well, I've often said, John, that it's impossible that a man or a woman who raises the amount of cash that's required to become president, who earns as little as they earn while presidents, can suddenly lead the presidency as multimillionaires. And it, you know, if they say they are there for you, that is their first lie.
Yeah.
You know.
So. Well, the problem is that the system we are returned to a cycle that happened roughly 2.5 centuries ago. It happens roughly every 2.5 centuries, 248 years to be exact, and it's a cycle in predictive astrology called the cycle of Pluto returning to Capricorn, the constellation of power, ambition, and the architecture of governance.
Okay.
And when Pluto moves into a sign, it defines for 20 to 30 years that it's in the sign, the color and the tone, the key of the music, if you will, of that generation, regeneration or degeneration.
Okay.
And what happens when Pluto enters Capricorn, which happened again starting 2008, 2009, and will be with us till 2024, you enter a period where an aristocracy reaches its point of crystallized power in the world. And at the same time, you see a rise of new middle classes. Middle classes are a threat to the aristocracy because they're literate, they're powerful, they're more talented, they're not old money, they're new money, and they're making it, and they're new ideas.
Right.
This started happening in the age of the Enlightenment in the 1760s, and with the rise in the middle classes in France and also the American colonies.
Mm-hmm.
And they're independent, they're dangerous, so you suppress them. So you see this thing going on in the world where the power elites want to manipulate and suppress the emergent middle classes. The middle classes eventually push back towards the end of the period of the Capricorn transit of Pluto. That happened at the end of the last one in 1777. A year before that was the Declaration of Independence. Several years before that, in 1773, was the first Tea Party movement.
Right.
Of the Sons of Liberty, which was actually the catalyst for the American Revolution and the Declaration of Independence. Now, that was the birth, 250 years ago, of modern democracies.
Right.
We are now back, full cycle, to review modern democracy in the world. And where it can turn from here is it can turn towards fascism, or it can redefine itself. Not just in America and Canada, but also in Europe,
right.
In other countries, in India. You also see, although this middle class that was born out of the last cycle is stagnating in America for the moment, one cannot deny the emergence of a global middle class in Indonesia, in Korea, in India, in China,
mm-hmm.
that is a huge explosion, a significant change. These people are going, the power elites over them, if in varying degrees, are going to want to control this emergent middle class in Asia. But they're going to run into eventually the same pushback that happened 250 years ago in America and France.
So do you think then that given these maneuverings, with what you have visioned for the immediate future, given those prophecies, those seers, if you will, do you see a new world order? Do you see that one world government that so many of our listeners send me email about? Do you see that new world order there, John, in the future?
No, and the thing that one has to understand with new world governments or 9-1-1 conspiracies or things like that is there are elements in national and international governments and in multinational corporations. Certainly they're trying to create that dream.
Right.
But they're doing it in an unsustainable way. The world cannot sustain, the world that they want to create cannot be sustained for another 10 to 15 years without serious collapse of the ecology, the climate, and resources. You cannot have this consumerist, consumptive concept of value in the economy that believes in its dogma that you can just, by faith alone, not by fact, find new markets, expand your numbers. The more customers you give birth to, the more customers you can buy and sell things to. There is a certain limit to this thinking that is reaching critical mass between now and 2020. And I even say in my book, Predictions for 2011, that I have a chapter about, I call it the alarm bells of the unsustainable.
Mm-hmm.
But we are going to see next year one of those first alarm bells begin to clang once in a while, not be a steady ring yet, but a cling, a clang
right.
for once in a while. And it's
right.
food sustainability.
Right.
The fact that Russia, a third of the grain export producer, had to stop exporting because of the fires that had ravaged it in this lingering drought. That is the beginning of something that's not going to recover next year. It is going to be worse. And what it's going to do is bring to the world's attention, hopefully to mainstream leadership, that we have a very serious shortfall in grain reserves. It's been one of my longest themes, and one I feel the most a voice in the wilderness crying out, talking about that other John in the desert, that there are two things that I constantly harp on that are coming for issue. One is food sustainability. The biggest danger we all have in the next 20 years of something apocalyptic carrying us off is not war as much as it is famine.
Right.
The other thing that's there, which is close to war, is war, and that is the war that everybody thinks won't happen. And there are a lot of prophecies that talk about this war. Everybody thought it wouldn't happen, and suddenly there it was, and it is thermonuclear war between Russia and America. It is a theme that I constantly come back to. One of the most important things that are happening in the next few weeks is whether the American Senate will ratify the new START Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty.
Right.
It's not enough, but without it, everything between these two nations go adrift. And there are future scenarios that show that very quickly the burgeoning friendship between the two great brothers of the North that Nostradamus talks about,
mm-hmm.
he describes them by a term that means eagle kings.
Right.
Their symbols are the eagle. Well, America has the bald eagle. The double-headed eagle is now the symbol of Russia since 1992. So we're talking about now.
Right.
And we're talking about a timeline that is 3 years and 7 months or 13 years. He gives two timelines, Nostradamus. Mm-hmm. but not the date of the beginning of the breakup of the friendship. But through Middle Eastern terrorist North African sources, the Middle East brings down these two brothers who are not yet brothers, and they go to war.
Mm-hmm.
And the victor is born on the soil of Amerish, which is America.
Right. And
now,
I think
just to finish quickly, it's a complicated thing. I'll finish it now, is that if Barack Obama does not ratify this treaty, and if things go sour between the Soviet Union and the United States, that 3.7-year timeline, which I thought had been disengaged by this START treaty, will be enacted again.
Right.
We could see in 2016 or 2012, 2013, some serious crisis. I'm hoping, though, that because the Russians seem to be, despite their return to having a neo-czarism, it is stable. And as long as Russia remains stable, unless this food thing undermines Russia, then we might have more time, and we're not going to worry about this until the 2020s. But it's out there, just like famine. They're both out there, and they're not being addressed.
Right. And we've seen the Earth as it's changed with the climate that has been changing now. Some are claiming that countries are manipulating their weather programs and it's gone awry. There's the theorists for political HAARP and the likes, yeah. Now, do you see...
It's all ridiculous.
Yeah.
I will say the future will, as some of your listeners scream at hearing me and are now cussing,
they'll get it.
I want to say for the record that when it's all said and done, my statement will be vindicated by the future. There are certainly people and things, attempts to create a world order, but it is in chaos, just like the rest of the world.
Mm.
It has its own special interests, and it's also based on a dream that's unsustainable. So that doesn't mean there might be something like that in the future. And after the 2050s, the biggest challenge for the human race is when we've sorted all this out and have a more interrelated global society. Our ability to create virtual reality may, in the end, be the greatest challenge to our continued evolution on this planet, because it creates a pyrite golden age.
Right. Now, with all of this said, John, when you see what's coming ahead, you are talking 2050, so your confidence is high that we will clear the hurdle of December the 21st, 2012, with a society left to sustain and improve upon, right?
2012, I'm also putting together an ebook that will be out in mid-February at the latest, which is finally, I let all of the 2012 industry have its run.
Mm-hmm.
with all the silly stuff that was said in the name of 2012. And not so silly, some interesting stuff, but a lot of good stuff lost in the cacophony of sensationalism.
Right.
Now I'm going to write a book where we hose it down, take 2012 out of being the Lindsay Lohan of doomsday dates, and bring it down to what it really means and what its true significance is. And the interesting fact astronomically that's come out is that the galactic center that Vincent Bridges and other people that are on these shows with me keep exulting about is it's actually past the Olmecs, who are the basis to the calculations of the Maya, are, if you actually talk to real anthropologists who speak Maya, studied it for 30 years and looked at the mysteries of their calendar, the Olmecs were very good timekeepers, but they can only be as good as people without exact computer science. And the fact that they may have been off by 13 years is remarkable for what they achieved and handed on to the Maya. But the galactic center alignment happened in between the winter solstices of 1998 and 1999. The 2012 has happened. The 2012 everybody's waiting for in a few years. happened 13 years before. And so with that in mind, I look at a book that then looks at, okay, beyond all the prophetic hyperbole, what is significant about the end of the 1990s? And what's also intriguing is Nostradamus' 2012 and 1999. He made that very clear. You know, and for all these people who said he's learned some Mayan astrology and cauldron gazing and all of that,
right.
I'd like them to explain to me why, at a time when saying 2012 was the big date, would have not gotten him in any trouble whatsoever with the Inquisition, because no one cared. It's too far in the future.
Right.
Why didn't he, if he had all this knowledge about 2012 as the date, why did he say the end of the world was happening in the year 3797? And why did he look at 1999 as the apex point of a shift in human history?
Yeah.
And not 2012.
Yeah. And again, like you say, the hyperbole and the story upon story and just the general grunge that gets on something that's that old just really muddies the water, doesn't it? It just makes it difficult to show people that there is a frequency, there is a cycle of life that we're not quite understanding. And that cycle of life has come to an end for us tonight, John. It's got a couple of minutes remaining here. So I just do want to make sure that everybody's on the same program. HogueProphecy.com. Go there, go to the guests section, and there you can sign in and join up to the newsletter and the likes, and keep on John's blog. And next month, predictions 2011, John. Good luck on that one.
Yes, we should hopefully do a show soon, in January or late December.
Whenever you are available, it's always a pleasure, sir.
It's a prophecy in the making.
Well, there we go.
We'll be signed off by December 5th.
Fabulous. John, it's been an absolute pleasure, sir. You take care of yourself, and you just keep doing what you're doing, because we definitely do respect it.
Well, thank you very much. And keep warm up there.
Thank you very much, John. Bye. Well, ladies and gentlemen, John Hogue from HogueProphecy.com. Now, just before we close tonight, I do want to say it is cold outside. It is very, very cold outside. And there are thousands of people in North America that are suffering cold and hunger as we speak. And I ask you, just for no reason at all, just to reach out to one, if nothing else. Provide them with the ability to reach out for two. And with that said, remember the golden rule, but for the grace of God go I. Blessings on your household.
Hey, Night Zoners, got a minute? I'm sure we all know someone who is experiencing difficult times during this recession, either with unemployment or financial problems, or in relationships. I have friends like that. I would like to remind you that we are all in this together. So if you have friends experiencing hardships, support them with your advice. If you have acquaintances who are having rough times, nurture them with your friendship. Show them kindness. If you have family members who are having difficulties, show them your love. And if you have people in your life who have almost given up, throw them a lifeline of kindness. Remember the golden rule, but for the grace of God, go I. Blessings upon your household. Until then, next time we meet.
This has been a Night Zone production in association with BlogTalkRadio.com.